infectious myths, we'll talk with somebody who was falsely diagnosed HIV positive and who took the drugs for years, experiencing terrible side effects, and now he is struggling for justice. I'm David Crow, your host for The Infectious Myth, and my guest is going to be Bobby Russell. Before I start asking him about his story, I want to remind you that you can contact me by email at david.crow, that's Crow with an E, at theinfectiousmyth.com. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth, or follow us on Twitter at infectiousmyth. Thanks for being a listener and supporter. If you'd like to support in other ways, please contact me. To be honest, the best thing you can do for me right now is to listen to the show, but you're obviously already doing that, so the next thing to do is to tell your friends that they need to listen. Live or via podcast, it doesn't make a lot of difference. If you think these stories are important, help me broaden my audience. Anyway, welcome to the show, Bobby.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate your allowing me.
Yeah. Well, I interviewed you once before on the podcast, How Positive Are You?, that I co-host with Elizabeth Ely. But there's been a major development in your case, so I thought I would like you back. So just briefly, in August 2013, you found that you were actually false HIV positive. You eventually stopped taking the AIDS drugs and filed a lawsuit against several doctors, the University of Kentucky Hospital, and others over what you went through for more than 8 years. But more recently, your case was dismissed, and we'll get into the rather absurd reasons why that happens, and you're trying to raise the money to appeal it in this modern justice system. But let's go back to September 2004, where you were diagnosed. You didn't know it was a false diagnosis at the time, but you were diagnosed HIV positive. Did you ask for an HIV test?
No, I did not actually ask for an HIV test. I had actually had a test done on August the 4th of 2004 with the health department, and I thought that that would be a routine screening process. At that time, that was all that I was known that could be used for detection of HIV, but wow, have I learned something since then. But nevertheless, I was in the hospital due to a recent surgical procedure that took place several months before, and it resulted in me bleeding from my colon, and it was due to low platelet count, and I was not able to clot my blood, and I had broke loose bleeding for several months, and therefore it had, in my opinion, had weakened my immune system because of lack of nutritional issues going through with the pain and the problem of the bleeding. But there was never a test that was requested. It was suggested, but it was I'd never requested it because I'd had a test done less than a month prior. So one misunderstanding that the courts are not understanding correctly about the case, I believe.
Right. I think there's a lot of things they don't understand, and we'll go to that later once people understand how you got to where you are today. So what you're saying is in August 2004, you tested HIV negative?
Yes, I did at the local health department under the test known as an ELISA test, which are known for many faults and problems itself, but nevertheless, I passed that test as I had always had passed.
Right. So, now, I mean, I should point out that although if an ELISA is reactive, sometimes called positive, then you need to do additional testing. But if an ELISA is negative, that's considered HIV uninfected. So if you had a negative ELISA and they told you you were uninfected, they were following the proper procedure. But things went wrong in September when you got tested again, and this time they told you you were positive, right?
That would be correct. They actually, the process was, you know, mind you, these ELISA tests, they take approximately 7 days, 5 to 7 days, not 5 to 7 hours to do, as the documents show. But nevertheless, the test, they claimed that a test was administered on the 17th of September at about 9:30 or 11 o'clock at night. And the blood was lost twice before obtaining the third blood sample. So I had questions really about the test, and then the very next morning on the 18th, though, at about 9 o'clock in the morning, I was approached by a physician, and they told me that my test had came back positive.
Wait a minute. You told me that these tests take several days. So is it the ELISA that takes several days, or is it the Western blot that takes several days?
I believe that both tests would take several days to do, because in order to test to see if a person has a virus in their blood, that virus has to be extracted from the blood specimen itself and then reintroduced into a clean sample, and then the time is needed and required in order for that test to grow within the sample to determine if the sample matches or not. So
yeah.
It's a process that takes more than just hours. It would take at least a couple of days to do.
Right. Well, the Western blot, I believe, does take several days. So they clearly did not have a Western blot on September the 18th, but they told you you were HIV positive, and that is usually interpreted as saying you're HIV infected. But they obviously did not have a Western blot, which is mandatory in the United States for confirmation of an HIV test or some kind of confirmatory test, usually the Western blot. There's other types of confirmatory tests, but I don't believe any of them can be done in less than 24 hours.
Well,
and,
even if they were done in less than 24 hours, it would have, you know, the ELISA test would have had to be returned within 7 hours, because I was told at 9 o'clock in the morning on the 18th that the test
right.
was positive and that I was positive. But mind you, that would, you know, this test that I'm talking about, that ELISA, that doctor told me at 9 a.m., and a viral load test was not even drawn until
right.
11:30 that morning. So I was diagnosed before a viral load test was administered, and well before a Western blot test was administered. And the ELISA test, if it takes more than 12 hours to do, then that means I was diagnosed with no
test. Right. Yeah, I mean, the ELISA tests do take time. There are rapid tests, but you weren't given a rapid test, so it is a bit of a mystery what they were telling you. And are there reasons why these doctors would have been anxious to... Well, let me step back a second. Did they consider you to be in a risk category for HIV infection?
I believe that majority of, from what I've learned and from what I've read through material, that one of the screening methods that they use is people that do not meet the standards of the society of America as we know today. They target people such as black or African Americans, homosexuals, bisexuals, transgendered people, people that use drugs. They screen that. They use that as a screening tool, merely as a way of diagnosing, basically, in my opinion.
I mean, that's actually official now, that the CDC said that a doctor is allowed to diagnose somebody as HIV infected by putting a note in their file and then following it up and getting a single confirmatory, a single test that's an indication of HIV infection, not necessarily even an HIV test, so it could be like a CD4 immune cell count. but back then in 2004, that was not the rule. The rule was still you need to have multiple ELISA tests and a Western blot. And I also believe that if the ELISA, if the first ELISA test is reactive, that they're supposed to draw another blood sample and do the second ELISA test using new blood. But they clearly didn't do that.
Correct. Well, they claimed that on the 20th of September, 2 days after being diagnosed, I was terribly upset, and I told them that the test was negative in August, and that I demanded for a Western blot test to be done, because in 2004, the Western blot test was known to be the confirmatory test.
Right.
So I had the test requested, and I did the test on September the 20th, and at the time, their protocol, I believe, shows that We submit the blood first to an ELISA, and then it's forwarded over to another laboratory for a Western blot analysis. And at that time, the ELISA test was negative and non-reactive, and that sample was also tested through the Western blot labs, and it was determined that it was also non-reactive and negative. But those results probably at least did not come back until after I was discharged from the hospital on September the 24th. So I was diagnosed with the assumption that because I had a positive or a reactive ELISA, and based upon a viral load for a different condition that I had besides a condition thought to be HIV, then it was ruled that I had HIV disease. However,
if they tested you on the 20th through the Western blot analysis, and those were non-reactive, and those may those results may have come back after the 24th, so that's fine. But didn't they phone you right away and say, you know, there's been a bit of a mistake, and we need to talk to you about your HIV status?
Actually, no. At the time, I was to follow up my care from the hospital with a infectious disease specialist known as Dr. Artis Hoven. And I had requested her on that visit on October the 4th that I was there to merely get the results of my Western blot test. And she gave me quite a scare, and I told her that I need to know what the results of the test was. And without her getting up off her stool and going looking in the computer, she asked another physician what the result of the test was. And that physician was going, had answered the question based upon the test that was administered on the 17th, and I was talking about the test that was administered on the 20th.
So they told you you were positive, but did they not have the later test results, or what?
They should have had it. It should have been returned well before October the 4th from the September admission to the hospital.
One would hope that all of these doctors are talking to each other. I mean, given that the hospital told you to find an infectious disease specialist, one would imagine that all laboratory tests would be forwarded to that person, and if not, that the doctor had a responsibility to go get the test results.
It was a strong issue with failure of communication and not double-checking.
You're way too understated. So this is October 2004 now. What did they say about AIDS drugs?
They told me that the sooner that I started the medication regimen, that the longer that I could live. And I just said, no, I don't believe you. I just don't believe you. I need the test. I want to see the test. And she said, well, we'll get you the test, but we need to get you on this medicine. Let's let you get you signed into a ADAP program, which is an AIDS drug assistance program. And they were more anxious to get me enlisted into this KDAP program or ADAP program than there was to even look for the test result. And, you know, I finally, you know, when we move forward into the months of December, you know, 2 or 3 months later, I thought, wow, well, the doctor must be right, and I must be wrong. So maybe if I do have HIV, because at that time I was still scared that, you know, HIV was a real issue. And I thought that she had to be right. She was sworn under oath that she would protect me and take care of me with her medical license. And I learned she was just very negligent.
I guess you learned a lot about how the medical system really works as opposed to how it says it works. So did you go on AIDS drugs in December of 2004 then?
I actually started the AIDS medications on, I believe it was December the 4th or December the 8th. It was in 2004, December of 2004. But at that time, when she put me on the medications, and I went to see her that day, she said, okay, what I'm going to do is I need to get your viral load at the time that you began your treatment, your heart therapy. So
right.
Since you're going to start your medicine tonight, let's go ahead and do a viral load test today. So I did the viral load test.
Yeah.
And it was
And what was the result of that?
It was undetectable, meaning negative. It really was negative. The only way that you're undetectable is if you're known to have HIV and you're not able to obtain a copy or copies of the virus in the blood, then you are considered to be undetectable. But you've got to first establish a diagnosis from a real test before you can determine if someone's
right.
detected or undetectable.
I mean, HIV theory says that you can still have HIV in your body with an undetectable test. It's just not, it's so little of it that our tests cannot pick it up, which makes you wonder how the virus can actually do anything if this ultra-sensitive test, which is based on polymerase chain reaction, if the ultra-sensitive test can't detect any virus in your body, how can it be causing you illness? But in your case, you were undetectable, and they're saying, okay, well, that's good because you don't have much virus, so you should take drugs to keep it low, right?
That would be correct.
And what were the drugs you started?
Wow,
you remember?
It's been so long. I think that I might have started off on Truvada and AZT and Comavir. I believe that might have been the combination that I started off on.
Well, it doesn't really matter, but let me read some information from the Truvada label, and this is produced, this label is printed by the manufacturer, and so it's presumably not being overly negative about the drug. But some of the things it says are, it has a black box warning saying lactic acidosis, which is the buildup of lactic acid in the blood, which can be fatal. Severe hepatomegaly, which is enlarged liver, with steatosis, which is fat deposits in the liver, including fatal cases have been reported with the use of nucleoside analogs alone or in combination. And AZT is a nucleoside analog, and Truvada is also. Kidney damage, including cases of acute renal failure, decreases in bone mineral density. Let me see what else. Buffalo hump, peripheral wasting, facial wasting, breast enlargement. Immune reconstitution syndrome has been reported, which basically means AIDS conditions that occur only after you start the drugs. Long-term effects of Truvada are unknown. And then there's a long list of various side effects. Diarrhea, nausea, fatigue, sinusitis, nasopharyngitis, sleepiness, headache, dizziness, depression, insomnia, abnormal dreams. Significant laboratory abnormalities, cholesterol, creatine kinase, serum amylase, joint pain, cough, upset digestion, fever, muscle pain, abdominal pain, back pain, hallucination of any senses, peripheral neuropathy, which is either pain or numbness in the periphery of your body, pneumonia, inflamed nose, rash, and so on. So there's quite a list of side effects with these drugs.
And that's where the pharmaceutical industry gets rich, because for all those side effects that you have, you end up needing to require to take more medications to cover up those side effects of the pills that's caused from the pills that you're taking to fight a disease.
And what's wrong with this picture? I mean, it seems like it's a money-making system. It's just a few people have to suffer in order for the pharmaceutical industry, pharmaceutical companies to get richer. What were some of the major side effects that you experienced after you started ARVs?
I had a lot of numbness in my body. Sometimes I would think that I was suffering from maybe a stroke,
mm-hmm.
but I believe that was probably in all reality because there was a wasting issue going on, and there was a lot of probably fat
redistribution
through my body, And it caused a lot of numbness, especially bone pain. And it really triggered on one side, and I often thought that I was having maybe a stroke.
Well, you know, yeah, that would be a symptom of a stroke, right?
Well, but it was kind of, I guess maybe now I've learned that it really probably was never an issue about a stroke. It was more of an issue about diabetes because of my nutritional issue that continued to go on.
And so did you have diabetes before you started this whole thing in 2004?
No one has yet to diagnose me with diabetes, but I maintain an elevated levels of glucose, which could indicate diabetes. And if I don't have diabetes, then I suffer from high levels of glucose levels in my body. And I believe that could be causing the imbalances issues and the neuropathy issues. And I mean, it was just, these drugs were horrible. And
you mentioned nutritional issues. Like, are you saying that you had a bad diet at this time?
Yes, I did have a bad diet. When you're depressed, you really just don't want to eat. And I was, obviously, I was suffering from a strong case of mental issues that was going on because my mother had passed away years before.
Right.
And I probably never coped with it correctly.
Right.
You know, the reality of all this is that in August, when I had an HIV test done in 04, that's when I was eventually approved for Social Security disability based upon a mental condition. Now, if you are known to be really, really damaged or depressed at one point, you know, that can very well as also can weaken your immune system. But then when you have someone to tell you that you have HIV and just right on top of that, your life is destroyed. And you fall victim to isolation, darkness, fear, and you don't eat. And
My problem with the word depression is it's become medicalized because, you know, somebody, I mean, you obviously had other issues, but when somebody tells you you've got a fatal virus and the only thing you can really do is to take drugs that you learn pretty quickly have pretty terrible side effects, that's depression, but you don't need an antidepressant for that. You need to resolve the issue, which in your case was exacerbated by taking drugs, which had a whole laundry list of side effects.
I was zombified. I was in a zombie. I walked like a zombie. I thought like a zombie. You know, the thinking skills are not there.
Right.
It's so terrible. It's just such a terrible issue, and I hope that what I have to say about this whole issue that's going forward can hopefully prevent someone else from starting these terrible drugs, and to really focus with what's the most important thing in their health and what is going on with their body, instead of just giving your life away to somebody and say, do whatever you want to do with me, I'm done.
Right, so what did you do about your nutritional issues? Like, did you get on top of that eventually?
I had sought counseling from 2004 until 2009, late 2009. And in February of 2010, when my doctor that was treating me for the previous 5 years, basically for the HIV, she had sent me a notice and told me that she could no longer be my physician, that she was wanting to focus more with the American Medical Association, as she had been elected as the president-elect of the program, and that, however, she was not going to be able to treat me anymore, that she would need to refer me to one of the other physicians in the clinic.
Mm-hmm.
But on the day that I got the letter in the mail, which I believe was like February 22nd, 2010, I received a phone call as well from my psychiatrist or from my therapist, and the therapist thought that I was just probably just just crazy that I didn't have no logical thinking by what I was needing, and what I was needing was a copy of my confirmatory test from the hospital.
Right.
But everyone thought that I was completely crazy, and this lady on that day, she called me and told me that she would not treat me anymore for any psychiatric conditions. She would never treat me again. And I said, well, I'm suffering from a really bad issue here, and I really think I need help. Please give me a referral. And she refused to give me a referral and told me that if I had contacted her office one more time for an appointment, that she would have me disciplined through the University of Kentucky policies. So I quit seeing. I just quit going to therapy. Of course, they withdrew the medication, which was really a blessing in disguise. But I discontinued the use of the medications and probably found myself locked into a deeper issue going on because I had so many questions and nobody would give me no answers.
Well, I was going to ask you if you had any support. Like, did your family know what was going on, or did you have friends who knew you were HIV positive and what you were going through, or not?
Not really. My family had no clue. I had to keep them in the dark. I was humiliated. I didn't know what was going on myself. And I was originally from a small town of maybe 1,200 to 2,000 people with a population. I would have been completely ridiculed there. My family would have been ridiculed. And to stay away from all of those types of issues and not to bring no harm to my family, I chose to stay in Lexington, isolated from my family, and not allow them to see me, because at that point I had already started wasting, and I wasted a lot. And I felt that I probably, since nobody would listen to me, I gave up on everyone.
Right.
And I had that, you know, because nobody wanted to start treating me in February of 2010, I had already, at that point, I had already began the procedures for committing suicide, and nobody really knew it.
So that was a low point, but you hung on for another 3 years before you found out that you were not actually HIV positive at all. So can you describe how you discovered that you were not HIV positive?
Well, between 2010 until 2013, I was shifted among probably four more doctors back and forth. When I'd ask the doctor for the confirmatory, I would get shifted to someone else. I would ask them, where's the confirmatory? And I would get excuses. You need to go back to your source to obtain that information. We don't have it. And nobody could provide it to me. Even the hospital, when I was discharged, I asked for the medical record, and I wanted to know what the Western blot test was with my own eyes, but the Western blot test was not in those records that was requested on the 24th upon my discharge. So that's the reason that leads me to believe that the Western blot test returned after I was discharged from the hospital, because it was not in the medical records when I had requested them when I was discharged from the hospital.
Okay.
So I knew, I was very certain that I had that test done on the 20th, and eventually, I would say maybe in the late fall of 2011, I was seriously, strongly demanding for the test, and nobody would provide it to me. And at that time, I had no primary care physician, because I felt like that I had been betrayed by so many people that I could not trust. That my trust was just eliminated from there. So I did think that I could trust one doctor that I had treated me for about 6 or 8 years, probably about 6, I guess, at that point. But I contacted him because I had had maybe the flu or some lung infection going on, and I needed treatment for the COPD that I had been treated for previously. So
COPD is chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, right? So difficulty breathing.
Yes. But I think that a lot of the breathing issues was a result from the anxiety and the anxious and the being really stressed out, really just pushed to my limits. And
right.
My inhaler would help me catch my breath. But anyway, I saw the doctor in February of 2012. And when I saw him in his clinic and not at the Bluegrass Care Clinic, he told me then that he needed to do an HIV test on me. And I was like, what? Are you serious? You've been my doctor for years. And he said, well, but you're in my clinic now, and you're not in the Bluegrass Care Clinic, and I need confirmation in my clinic that you have HIV before I can treat you down here. And I said, you know, just obtain the form from upstairs. And he says, well, I've never seen it, but I need it in my clinic, so you're going to have to do an HIV test today. Now, that
right.
type of test would not have been a viral load test. It would have had to have been an ELISA test.
Probably so, followed by a Western blot, one would imagine.
Well, you know, but I had asked on March the 6th for the test as I went in for a doctor's appointment or for a dental appointment in a different clinic.
Right.
And when I got in there, they told me that they said, oh, your results came back this morning. We'll print those off for you. Well, they printed them off for me, and I got home, and I reviewed them, and the test said negative for HIV-1. And now the record shows that it was undetected.
So this was the viral load test result.
Well, you know, it was really supposed to be an ELISA test. It
right.
was never supposed to be a viral load test. And, you
right.
know, a viral load test can only render a decision or an answer of detected or undetected. And
right.
an ELISA test would have to render the decision of either negative or positive.
Well, so, reactive or non-reactive.
Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, I pondered on it, and I laid it down. And then I forgot where I laid it, and I misplaced it with all the files that I had going on. So I went back to ask for a copy of it again, and they refused to give me a copy of it. And they told me that they could not release the copy unless I accepted to go to see one of the other doctors in another clinic for them to explain the test results. And I said, you know, I'm capable of reading. I just want the test result.
Right.
And they refused. They refused until I agreed to see a doctor, which was Alice Thornton and Dr. Gundali, in August of 2013. I didn't want to go, but they forced me to go. Even the UK administration forced me to go before I could ever obtain a copy of the test result.
Right.
And I went, but I sat in the patient room for an hour almost, basically an hour. And nobody never showed up, so I left. So
right.
then they told me that they still would not release it to me until I agreed to see the doctor. So I went back the next time, which would have been in December. Maybe the appointment might have been December 13th of 2013. And at
right.
that time, the Dr. Thornton had told me that it appeared that I had never been given a confirmatory. And I knew that I had. And so I made the attempt again to request for the medical record from the hospital, and I believe that the medical record, the request was done somewhere about maybe December the 15th or the 18th or somewhere around those period of 2013.
Right.
And eventually after the medical record was printed off on December the 28th of 2013, or excuse me, of 2012, And because of it being printed off, I did not get the result in the mail until January the 4th of 2013. And,
right.
you know, looking at back through all those medical records at the hospital, it probably took me another week. And so I'm looking at mid-January of 2013
right.
as to actually when I found out that the test result was negative, that everyone had considered to be positive for the 9 years that I had been going through treatment.
Okay, let me just emphasize that. So there was some question about whether you'd actually had a Western blot, which would have been a problem because that's like standard procedure to confirm an ELISA with a Western blot. But what you found was that they had indeed done a Western blot, but back in 2004 it came out negative, and you didn't find out that it was negative until 2013.
Until January of 2013, when I received the medical records by request, and I filed my lawsuit. I filed my lawsuit then on August the 26th of 2013, and I felt that I am within my statute of limitations of when I filed the lawsuit in reference to when I found out about the mistake.
Well, I'd like to now read an article from WTVQ Lexington. It's quite a short article, and I think it summarizes it, and it opens up a whole other issue, actually, at the end. But anyway, this is a third-party view of what happened. A big court ruling involving a Lexington man, which is you, Bobby Russell, who claimed that University of Kentucky doctors mistakenly told him he was HIV positive, only to find out nearly a decade later he wasn't. The question before the court was a suit filed in time. Fayette Circuit Judge Thomas Clark said it had been too long to sue for medical malpractice. Back in 2004, Russell said doctors at University of Kentucky Medical Center told him he was HIV positive, but he never saw the actual test results until 2013. When he finally saw them, the results were negative, that's the Western blot we're talking about, and so he sued. Lawyers for the university said it was too late. The statute of limitations had run out. The limit is 1 year in Kentucky for medical malpractice. Lawyers for the hospital claim Russell had doubts about a possible misdiagnosis years before he saw the negative results. But Russell's lawyer argued his client couldn't have had a case until Russell had his test results in his hands. Judge Clark released a written opinion stating he believes Russell's claim is untimely. Quote, "It is clear the plaintiff knew or should have known about the misdiagnosis before the mandated time frame. He knew he had been wronged and by whom. Moreover, he had been informed by others that the doctors at University of Kentucky had misdiagnosed him," said Judge Clark's written opinion. "This means the judge believes there is enough proof Russell knew about a possible misdiagnosis earlier and that the civil case was filed too late. Russell's medical malpractice case will only go before a judge if Russell appeals and then wins. His attorneys have not decided if they will file an appeal, and this is what the money is needed for." University of Kentucky sent out this response to the ruling, and this is very important, I think. Quote, "We are pleased that the court has granted summary judgment to the university's physicians. While this legal ruling was based on the statute of limitations, we feel equally strong that the underlying allegations of misdiagnosis had no merit. The court record includes evidence that Mr. Russell has had 5 subsequent Western blot tests that were positive for HIV after the very first Western blot test was negative." So there's a few things about this I find quite bizarre. The judge is saying quite clearly that you were wronged, which basically means that he's saying that you should win a suit against the hospital, but with this short period of time for medical misdiagnosis in Kentucky, he's saying that you were too late, and obviously that's a highly questionable decision. But what about these 5 subsequent Western blot tests that were positive? Where do they get that from?
They get one of those test results. They get one of the test results at the hospital in 2009, when I demanded for the test from Dr. Hoven before she resigned on me in February of 2010. I told her that I needed to know where the Western blot confirmatory test was so that I could turn the information over to the Veterans Administration.
Right.
And she told me she thought that it appeared that I had never been given a test and that she would need to give me another test. So a test was ordered on November the 25th, I believe it was, 2009. I'm not sure of the exact date, if it was 25th
okay.
or the 27th.
Well, close enough.
But I do know it was November 2009.
Mm-hmm.
And those test results, they actually came back negative. And a social worker for the state declared that she knew that I had been diagnosed in September of 2004 and that she felt that there must have been a mistake with the laboratory reporting agency, and that she had requested for the lab result to be reversed back to positive because she knew, or she thought she knew, that I had been diagnosed in September of 04.
So this is one of the most, there's a lot of bizarre things about this case. And when you look inside the medical system, you really have to shake your head. But, I mean, how can a social worker go back to the lab and say, your lab results were wrong, it should have been positive? And how did you find out about this?
She confirmed, I actually talked to her supervisor first, and her supervisor told me over the phone, and I asked her I wrote her an email to confirm it, and she said she did not want to discuss it in an email. And I knew then that she would never talk or she would never say it again. And I knew that if I ever got it as a part of a medical record, that I would have to have someone to tell me again. So I called the social worker that was responsible to maintain my health records, that would see that I was in to see a doctor or a dentist or those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
And I called her, and that's when she said, well, you know, we knew that you were diagnosed in September of 04, so you're positive. And I said, no, you know, you cannot change these test results. You do not change this. And obviously she did, and she is a UK employee, and furthermore, she is an employee under the Cabinet for Health and Family Services, more specifically through the KDAP program or through the AIDS Drug Assistance Program, which monitors how much the state can get for funding for drugs and medical treatment. But her testimony, those types of things wouldn't even discussed. This decision was very premature before the judge ever had a chance to review the clear information. He did not get all the facts, and I just think that was premature, and it really needs to be heard by, I had asked for a jury to hear the case, and I felt that I would be entitled to at least one day in court.
Well, I'm sorry to laugh, but I've seen enough bad things happen in the modern justice system that, you know, people outside the system think, I'll get my day in court, and then they don't realize that your opposition is going to get expensive lawyers, and they're going to say, well, gee, we can argue that this was, beyond the statute of limitations, and then we can have a discussion just about these dry legal issues about, you know, when did you know, how much time did you have, and maybe we can get the whole thing kicked out without ever talking about the merits of the case, because if they argue the merits of the case, and even if you lose, it's still all come out in the open. There's still going to be court hearings, and there's still going to be embarrassing things come out, and even if you were to lose on that, then they might still look pretty bad. But you've described one Western blot test, but they are saying five subsequent Western blot tests were positive.
Right. So,
and have you seen those?
So here's another one, is that in July 15th of 2009, before I'd asked for the test from Dr. Hovind that she'd given me, I had went through the process of trying to obtain my military benefits because of wishing to transfer my care to a different provider.
Right.
And the VA said, well, since you do not have a confirmatory Western blot test, then, you know, the next best thing that we have to go on is an oral quick test. It has no human contact whatsoever. So we need you to go to the local health department, and you tell them that we are sending you there for an oral quick. If your test is positive, then they need to contact us and let us know so that we can start your benefits.
Right.
But the oral quick test, and I did two of them. Not one, but two of those tests, and both of them were negative. So the person that was giving it to me at the health department called my doctor at UK and said, Dr. Hovind, I think something's wrong here. There's a problem. He's testing negative on an oral quick test. So immediately they say, give him a blood test. Give him a blood test. So, you know, I thought that they were acting in to the best interest for me. I didn't know that they were lying to me all along, but nevertheless, I went ahead and submitted myself to a blood test, and it was supposed to be an ELISA test.
Right.
Because an ELISA test would come back sooner than a Western blot, and it is a reduction of expenses for testing measures at the health department level, so they really only give an ELISA and not a Western blot.
Right.
The information, the ELISA, I was told, came back undetectable, and it was because that I was taking medications. But when the state submitted the information to Support UK, which I would have expected that, but when that information was submitted, they claimed that I tested positive for an ELISA and positive for a Western blot. I didn't even have a Western blot. And if I did, nobody never told me that the test result was positive.
Well,
no one.
One thing that we should talk about, because it's sort of being an underlying current in this whole discussion, although a lot of people probably don't realize this, is you described at first they wanted to get you on a benefit program. Now, a lot of people who've been diagnosed HIV positive and told that they need to take expensive drugs to stay alive probably don't realize that the vast majority of people who are taking AIDS drugs are getting the drugs paid for somehow. They're getting it through insurance or through a number of government programs. But doctors in universities like this, because there's always a little bit in these programs for the doctor or the hospital. So if they get you on a benefit program, then some of the money coming from that benefit program is probably going to their
institution,
to their services.
Right.
And so if they don't get you on this program, they know you can't afford the drugs. So their interest is get you tested positive, get you on a program, and start the flow of money coming into our clinic, hospital, university, or wherever.
Well, I would like to say that in the last few days or a couple of weeks that I've been looking through documents and things like that, strange that you mention that is because, you know, they were really quick to get me into the KDAP program in October of 2004. But, you know, in October 2004, I already had insurance and I already had prescription drug coverage. I already had Medicare and Medicaid, and I already had Part D program. So my medicines and my medical services were actually being paid for by my Medicare and my Medicaid and my prescription drug coverage. But I was also, told that I could only get those medications from UK Pharmacy, which was the most expensive pharmacy for those medications in this city. But nevertheless, the Ryan White Care Program under KDAP paid for the medicines and paid for the medical services and lab records and things like that, or labs to be drawn.
So in the last
couple of weeks, I've realized now that UK has obtained, I believe, double payment for the services that I've been given.
Well, I'm sure every time that you went into the University of Kentucky, whether you were picking up drugs or going for a visit with a doctor, that was immediately getting billed back to the government program, and they were making a killing on you. I think this is why hospitals and doctors love AIDS patients, because, first of all, the AIDS drugs are expensive, so if you're dispensing them, you're making a profit on them. Plus, they cause major side effects, so then you have to diagnose you have to prescribe additional drugs to cover the side effects. And, of course, every time there's a problem, there's an emergency room visit, there's a visit to a doctor, and those are all getting billed as well. So you became a real profit center for University of Kentucky. Did they put you in any clinical trials or talk to you about going on clinical trials for drugs?
They never really did talk to me about going on any type of clinical trials because they knew really that I had already my private sector insurance. But they were already making a killing off me with just antiviral medicines. I mean, I think maybe two bottles of medicines for like $5,500 a month that was being billed to my prescription drug coverage, but then the hospital was already receiving that $5,500 that month from through the Ryan White Care Program for those medicines. So they actually got $11,000 a month from medicines that cost $5,500 that I didn't even need.
Right. This is all kind of bizarre. And maybe you're right that the reason they didn't want to get you on clinical trials is I've read of several cases where people who had no insurance were offered clinical trials because the argument is, gee, you can't afford these expensive drugs, but if we put you in a clinical trial, the drugs are free. So a lot of people jump at that, not knowing that in clinical trials, they actually don't know ahead of time if the drugs you're taking will help, that you might be put on a placebo. So that becomes the medication for the really poor, which is basically taking a crapshoot. Of course, sometimes if you're on a placebo, it's better than on the actual drug. But usually in an AIDS drug trial, it's not a placebo. It's usually combination one versus combination two. So you're getting AIDS drugs in both cases, and so you could guaranteed to get the side effects.
Right.
And, now, one of the things...
You know, and they make sure that you get them. They make sure that you get the side effects. You know, AZT was the most difficult for me. It just about destroyed me. I mean, emotionally and physically, it about destroyed me. And, you know, when people talk about the ADAP programs and stuff like that, what I just don't understand is what is really the necessity of them. Because if under the Obamacare program, if everyone is responsible to have insurance, then I don't understand what is the program paying for if everyone's responsible to have insurance and pharmaceutical insurance.
You hear about these things all the time. I remember that remember reading somewhere that the city of San Francisco, which had a lot of AIDS cases, there was some question about whether an AIDS patient belonged to San Francisco based on the fact that they lived in San Francisco or they were diagnosed there. So there could be people who lived outside San Francisco, came to a doctor inside San Francisco and got diagnosed there. Or there could have been people who lived in San Francisco and went to a doctor outside to get treatment, and the city of San Francisco decided that they were going to count both. So they weren't necessarily providing any services to some of these people, but they were going to claim them from the government, and then they'd get a grant based on the number of people they had classified as AIDS in San Francisco. So I think there's so much money involved with AIDS that the corruption is gone entirely through the medical system.
The trust in our government system has just about diminished.
The medical system, if people knew what went on, would have. I mean, I know that the confidence in the U.S. Congress is like 26% or something, but I think if people knew what happened in the medical system, it would be even lower than that.
That's why the budget cannot. The budget deficit, the presidential's budget, and his deficit continues to climb. It's because healthcare costs and pharmaceutical costs continue to climb. But those things are supposed to be covered under insurance programs now and not, but they are, and here they are still requesting for more funding, we need more funding. How much more funding do you need when everybody is supposed to be on an insurance program?
Well, not only that, but I mean, these are highly toxic medications and they're not tested on the basis that they make people healthier. They're tested on the basis that they change people's viral load or they increase their CD4 immune cell counts. They're not tested on the fact that people feel better on them. And I always like to quote an article from the New York Times in 2006. If I can just find it here. Which was written by an AIDS doctor, and it says that the skeletal fellow reading a magazine, skin pulled taut over his skull, folds of denim covering his wasted legs, is actually one of our big successes. He is perfectly well, at least as far as his HIV infection goes, 10 years ago, and this was written in 2006, so they're referring to 1996, which is when the protease inhibitors came out. 10 years ago, he was dying of AIDS. Now he is living with it, or more accurately, living almost without it. His immune system normal, no trace of virus detectable in his blood. It is the life-saving drugs that have transformed his appearance like this, leaching the fat from his body even as they clear the virus from his blood. That was June 6, 2006 in the New York Times. And I think that accurately summarizes the outlook of doctors on AIDS patients from a point of view that we're making them sick, but we look at the numbers and their numbers are getting better, so things are good. Now, Bobby, we only have a couple of minutes left, so I'd like you to explain why people should give money to your case. You have a GoFundMe.com website, which we will put in the show notes, but if people want to write it down, it's GoFundMe.com/AXWTHK. Now, what's the money going to go towards?
Every drop of these funds, that whatever I get for the donations through this site, I'm using it to fight my legal defense, to be able to appeal the case, to ask for the courts to really look at this, look at the whole entire picture. My life is online, and I may have only served my country for a short period of time, but I felt that I'm entitled to at least one day in court before a jury to let them decide what's going on here. But I know that it's taken a lot of my funds that I've gotten, I had saved up. It's basically left me bankrupt. But but this is about a case not only involving me, but this is involving every HIV patient in the state of Kentucky that I could almost say for sure. And because if the methodologies was not followed for me at the hospital in 2004, then who says that they've been followed for everyone else since 2004? And this is about waking people's eyes up. This case is about allowing the government to see where their money, where the taxpayer money is going to. The doctors have no idea, I don't think, that what these tests really mean. I mean, I don't know of any test that is really going to be 100% degree of accuracy to specify what the virus is, because they can pick up on so many different issues. And I think it's a case that really needs to be discussed in this millennium. And
yes,
I believe that I could help a lot of people, and I really need their help to
right.
help me with this.
Well, I think
I
think what the judge said is that you have a case, and if they can get rid of all the procedural roadblocks, which of course the legal system loves to throw up and the hospital is going to love to have in front of you, if you can get rid of the procedural legal roadblocks, then it sounds like you have a very strong case to get some compensation, and maybe that will wake up all the people over-diagnosing HIV and over-diagnosing the drugs and ruining people's lives. So we've run out of time, but I would just like to thank you so much, Bobby, for joining with me today. And people are welcome to write to me about the show and go to GoFundMe.com/AXWTHK to donate to Bobby's appeal. Thank you very much.
Yes. Thank you. It is actually called the Bobby Russell Support Fund on GoFundMe.com. So
okay.
That's how.
Thank you.
That was great.
Goodbye.
Thank you for your interview. I appreciate it.
Okay. Goodbye, Bobby, and thanks for listening.